The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Good Old Days. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the March-April edition of Good Old Days magazine. Since Easter is observed this month, I wanted to start out and read an Easter story for you. And this one is titled, Surprise Easter Egg Hunt, and this is submitted by Jean Bridge. When I was approximately 5 years old, about 1938 or 39, we lived in Warm Springs, Virginia, with a household full of people. Mother's two sisters, Leona and Bee, lived with us while attending Valley High School near Hot Springs. In addition, Lanier, Dad's first cousin, also lived with us because one day, on a whim, Lanier's father had sold their home and everything in it, leaving Lanier without a place to sleep. Dad came home and gently asked Mother in a pleading tone of voice, "Carrie, do we have room for Lanier to spend the night? Because Luther sold his house today and everything in it, and Lanier has no place to sleep tonight." Mother, of course, replied yes, and Lanier moved in with us and stayed until he went into the service a year or two later. Also that year, Mother's brother, Mervin, had just gotten married to a pretty Baltimore girl and brought her on their honeymoon to meet Mother and Dad and to see the beautiful Virginia mountains. By my count, we had at least 8 people in the house at the time. However, this is really the story of one memorable breakfast. It was approaching Easter season, and this particular event has been etched in my memory for 33,580 breakfasts, more or less, and holds a prominent place in my heart. It was a Sunday morning with a slight chill in the air. Dad always loved spur-of-the-moment excitement. Mother was more prone to plan and have some idea of what she was doing, but Dad just jumped in with both feet and plunged ahead. The night before, Dad had announced at dinner that he and Lanier would be preparing breakfast the next morning. This did not surprise Mother because Dad was a good cook. So she relaxed and everyone enjoyed the evening. We were all just a little surprised when Dad's announcement included the statement, "Dress warmly," but no one asked why. The next morning at 4 o'clock, Dad and Lanier rolled out of bed and packed silverware, plates, cups, glasses, a coffee pot, 2 iron skillets, napkins, bacon, bread, cooking utensils, 2 dozen eggs, cream, sugar, coffee, salt and pepper, butter, trash bags, water, tea bags in case someone didn't drink coffee, a wash pan, 1 or 2 empty boxes, some hot pads, some strawberry jam, and an apron or two. Everyone started waking up around 6 o'clock, and pretty soon we all started gathering in the kitchen near the wood stove to stay warm until we had further instructions. Dad then gave specific instructions to Mother's brother on how to reach the top of Warm Springs Mountain. It seemed we were going out for breakfast. As we all piled into Mervin's car, someone said, "It seems we could have saved a lot of time and effort had we just eaten at home." Mother said, "Okay, quit complaining. He wanted to do something really special, and we are going to have a great time." We got everyone situated in the car, and we traveled 0.5 mile from our house down Klondike Road, and then traveled the 3 or 4 miles to the top of Warm Springs Mountain. Upon our arrival, we spotted Dad and Lanier with a healthy campfire going and girded out in aprons. When we got out of the car, the lovely smell of coffee perking assailed our nostrils. I think that's the day I decided that when I grew up, I was going to love coffee. In addition to the delightful coffee smell, the heavenly aroma of frying bacon tickled our taste buds. Then everybody got really excited about breakfast, but Dad had another surprise. He said, "Oh, by the way, since it's close to Easter, I forgot to tell you before we left home that the eggs for breakfast are all hidden and you have to find your breakfast." If I remember correctly, I believe there were some comments like, "You've got to be kidding. I've never had to hunt for my breakfast before. And what if I can't find an egg?" Dad smiled and said, "If we have any impaired participants, we'll help you." With that statement, everyone dispersed to find their breakfast. Pretty soon we heard an, "I found one," and then, "So did I," and so on. In short time, everyone seemed to have the necessary egg for their breakfast except me. I think Dad finally assisted me by kicking an egg out from under some leaves until I was jumping and yelling, "I got one!" In addition to the eggs and bacon, we toasted bread by hooking a slice on a long-handled fork and holding it over the fire. Then some butter was spread on the toast with a smidgen of strawberry jam. The wonderful smells of that breakfast cooking with a slight chill in the air and the laughter and banter among the hungry can still be caught up in my mind when I close my eyes and remember that nearly Easter egg hunt. Childhood memories are so important. I have always been thankful that Dad lived in the moment and loved things out of the ordinary, and I never heard Mother complain when someone needed a place to spend the night. But I have often thought of my aunt who had never been in the mountains and what an introduction she must have had. Next, we're going to go to the rewind section, and I'm going to share with you Easter shopping in 1946 style. After years of wartime rationing, Americans were ready to celebrate again, and Easter 1946 was a joyful return to color, candy, and Sunday best. Here's what a typical Easter shopping list might have looked like that spring. For a dozen eggs, you would have paid 59 cents. A box of chocolates would have cost anywhere from 50 cents to $2. An empty Easter basket was 10 cents to 30 cents, and a filled Easter basket would cost you 30 cents to $2. A greeting card would be 5 cents to 20 cents. A toy bunny or trinket would cost you 25 cents to $2. A child's Easter dress would be $5 to $15. And last, for a fresh flower bouquet, you would spend 50 cents to $3. Do you know which color jelly bean is the most popular? The answer, red. Red jelly beans have traditionally been the most popular among all the colors of this Easter favorite. Jelly Belly is the largest producer of jelly beans in the world and manufactures about 15 million annually. The company notes that Very Cherry was its most popular flavor for two decades until buttered popcorn took the top spot in 1998. However, after 5 years, Very Cherry retook the title and has remained the most popular ever since. Next, we'll be hopping back in time. Here are some classic Easter specials we still love. From Bonnets to Beagles, these 1950s to 1970s entertainment favorites made the holiday extra special. Easter Parade in 1948. Fred Astaire and Judy Garland light up this dazzling musical about showbiz, romance, and the joy of putting on your Easter bonnet. The Robe from 1953. A Roman soldier's life changes forever after the crucifixion of Christ in the stirring tale of redemption that was a box office favorite at the time. The Ten Commandments in 1956. Cecil B. DeMille's sweeping biblical epic became a TV Easter tradition, retelling Moses' story with grandeur and faith. King of Kings, from 1961. The reverent retelling of Jesus' life became a Holy Week viewing ritual for many families. Here comes Peter Cottontail. Made in 1971, this Rankin-based stop-motion classic follows a young bunny in training trying to save Easter. Pure vintage charm. Jesus Christ Superstar of 1973, Andrew Lloyd Webber's rock opera brings the last days of Jesus to life with bold music and a contemporary twist. Godspell of 1973. This joyful musical retelling of the gospel features modern-day disciples spreading love and song through 1970s New York. And last, it's the Easter Beagle, Charlie Brown, made in 1974. Linus insists the Easter Beagle is coming while the Peanuts gang gets sidetracked by their own holiday plans. The next story I want to share with you is submitted by Christina Hugo, and it's titled, An Incredible Encounter. Before my husband, Gordon, started working as a driver for the motion picture industry, meeting such celebrities as Anne Bancroft, Sylvester Stallone, and Donald Sutherland, he worked as a security guard at Universal Studios in California. His post was at the main gate where all the actors, crew, and staff entered for work. At that time, in the late 1970s, the entrances to the main and tour gates were both on Lancashire Boulevard, but they were several hundred yards apart. It wasn't uncommon for tourists trying to find the tour gate to turn their cars into the main entrance by mistake. Gordon and his partner would turn them around and head them in the right direction. Next to the main entrance was the executive building called the Black Tower, where all the business was conducted. Occasionally, the building was used as a location for shooting TV shows such as The Incredible Hulk. One afternoon, Gordon was in the booth as usual when suddenly standing next to him was actor Lou Ferrigno, the Hulk, alter ego to Bill Bixby's David Banner in full makeup and costume. Gordon, he asked, may I use your phone? Of course, this was before the cell phone era. The Incredible Hulk cast and crew had been filming in the Black Tower, and there was no phone available for the actors, so Lou had made a quick trip to the booth to make a call. Now, the booth phone was strictly for the security officer's use, but as my husband said, you don't say no to the Incredible Hulk. So Lou stepped into the booth and picked up the phone. At this exact moment, a car carrying a young family mistakenly pulled into the main entrance, looking to take the tour. Excuse me, said the driver, we're looking for... His voice trailed off as he and his family noticed who was standing inside the booth with a phone to his ear. It was the Incredible Hulk himself and all his huge, muscle-bound green glory. Gordon sent them on their way, mouths agape and eyes popping, to the correct entrance. I imagine that this incredible encounter is still a part of the lore of that fortunate family, told around campfires and holiday dinners. Hey, do you remember the time? Our next article comes from Good Old Days on the Radio, a duo of comedic charm. When Universal Studios informed comedians Bud Abbott and Lou Costello that their next venture would involve a team-up with Dracula, the Wolfman, and Frankenstein's monster, Costello was against the proposal. No way I'll do it, Costello told the head of the motion picture studio. My little girl could write something better than this. It took a $50,000 advance in salary and the signing of Costello's good friend Charles Barton as director of the picture to convince the comedian to go along with the idea. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein became the highest-grossing movie of their career, and Costello later recalled, they were right, I was wrong. In later years, neat films involving The Invisible Man in 1951, The Mummy in 1955, and several other horror film classic characters followed. The duo started in vaudeville. They first performed on radio in 1938 on the Kate Smith Hour. Their popular Who's On First routine made them a national sensation. After many appearances on a variety of radio programs, in the fall of 1942, the team finally had their own weekly radio program. They topped the popularity polls of Radio Daily and Radio Guide. In March of 1943, Costello was struck down with rheumatic fever. Abbott refused to perform without his partner, so the duo was temporarily replaced by Jimmy Durante and Gary Moore. Then, on the afternoon of November 4, 1943, during rehearsals for the evening's broadcast, Costello received a call from home. His son, Lou Jr., had accidentally drowned in the family swimming pool. The comedian rushed home to discover the news was accurate, as reported. Word spread through Hollywood, and numerous radio comedians volunteered to fill in for Costello that evening. To the surprise of everyone in the studio, Costello returned moments before airtime and went before the microphone to deliver his lines as scripted and rehearsed earlier in the day. Toward the end of the broadcast, Costello broke down, and Abbott explained the horrible news to the stunned radio audience. The Abbott and Costello show ran until the summer of 1949. By then, filming was completed for Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer, Boris Karloff. After that, Costello was bedridden for several months due to a relapse of rheumatic fever, the health ailment he battled back in 1943. His illness prevented ABC from renewing the contract for an additional season on radio. Soon after Abbott and Costello went to Mars in 1953 and faced off against Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, also in 1953, the team ventured into the television business. Produced by Costello's wife, Patricia, the television series lasted two seasons and gave the boys an opportunity to reprise the best comedic sketches and scenarios from their radio scripts. The next time you watch one of their television programs or one of their big screen movies, remember that the flat sarcasm of Abbott and shrieks from Costello originated on radio, which is the perfect medium for the kind of wordplay that Abbott and Costello were brilliant at and is often imitated at fan gatherings today. Our next article, Move Over, I'm Coming Through, and this is submitted by Jackie McTaggart. Ask any gal who was a teen in the 1950s about the fashions back then, and the item mentioned most will be the crinoline petticoat. Most girls opted for a single crinoline for school and multiple petticoats for dances and special occasions. I personally went the multiple petticoat route when I could escape my mother's before-school inspection routine, that is. Some teens starched, wax-ironed, or painted shellac on the thin netting of the skirts to increase their fullness, and others like me just put on more crinolines. It was a big ordeal to maintain crinolines and keep them fluffy. It was also an embarrassing situation when a skirt flew up in the wind or popped up if a girl didn't sit down correctly while wearing a balloon skirt. The paper doll look of the 1950s couldn't be achieved with simple cotton and lace slips. A 5-yard skirt needed 4 or 5 petticoats made of netting to achieve the Victorian volume that gals wanted. 5? Yep. 5 petticoats made of 10 yards or more of netting each was uncommon but not unheard of, especially among the rich. 3 of these were typical for me. In the 1950s, netting was lighter and airier and required wearing fewer petticoats, but it was also itchy and prone to flattening out with wear. Because Nettie needed to be stiff, popular women's magazines offered plenty of advice on how to keep them that way, including starching, damp pressing, and even ironing wax paper over the netting. Crinolines came in several lengths. The shortest was knee length. It was designed to end about 2 inches above the edge of the skirt. To have a petticoat show beneath the skirt or dress was a fashion faux pas. If this happened, a friend might say, "It's snowing down south," a polite old phrase indicating a visible white slip. My personal etched-in-the-mind forever memory regarding crinoline underskirts pertained not to the length, but rather to the width. My red face incident took place at the Franklin Hotel coffee shop in the town where I was born, Strawberry Point, Iowa. The year was 1954, and I was a sophomore in high school, working after school and on Saturdays as a waitress at the coffee shop. Strawberry Point was, and still is, a very small town where everyone knows each other's name and, to a large degree, their pedigree. A secret or embarrassing incident was usually common knowledge within the hour. My incident took place on a Saturday morning around 10 o'clock, in the time many of the town's businessmen and professionals gathered for a cup of coffee and, if they were lucky, a smidgen of gossip that might or might not be true. The first customers to arrive, mostly men, sat on the 10 stools bordering the counter, and late arrivals were ushered to tables in an adjoining area. The space between the counter and the wall that opened into the additional seating room was only about 4 feet wide, but that was okay as long as employees remembered to turn sideways when meeting a fellow worker traveling the opposite direction. Well, it was okay until the day I wore 4 due to a bigger-than-usual paycheck the previous week, brand-new fluffy crinolines under my poodle skirt. On my first trip down the narrow aisle, my beautiful, fashionable crinolines knocked 3 sets of salt and pepper shakers, 2 filled sugar bowls, and a stack of folded napkins off their shelf from the back of the counter and onto the floor. Marcella, the coffee shop's owner, cleared her throat and said, "Jackie, go into the restroom and remove all of these crinolines, and don't ever wear any of them to work again. You can clean up your mess when you get back." The chattering at the counter stopped instantly, and every eye turned my way. I don't remember if I said anything in response, but I do remember that I never wore a crinoline to work again. John T. King III submits our next article, Dress Code? What Dress Code? In the fall of 1966, I was hired by IBM to be a typewriter repairman for their Dallas office and was immediately sent to Philadelphia to their training center to learn all about their typewriters and dictating equipment. Since this was before the introduction of computers and copiers, every major business in the country employed hundreds of women to type thousands of letters every day. My job was to go to these offices and do routine maintenance on these typewriters, as well as take service calls for problems. There was no dress code at the training center because there was no contact with the public and it was just a casual atmosphere. But when I got back to Dallas and began working, that was a different story. I have always taken pride in my appearance and wanted to make an impression on everyone I had contact with, so I went to Ken's Man's Shop in Garland, Texas, and picked out some of the latest fashions for my business wardrobe. It is important to note that in the 1960s, virtually all men wore dark suits with white shirts, but styles were changing and Ken's had all the latest styles. Since I wanted to be stylish and not be just one of the guys wearing $30 Sears suits, I maxed out my credit cards and I got a beautiful blue $200 Kuppenheimer suit and an iridescent olive HIS suit for $165. That was an awful lot of money to pay for suits in 1966. But I was planning on a long career with IBM, and I considered it a good investment. To complement the suits, I bought several pastel Van Hoosen shirts, 4 beautiful Oleg Cassini ties, some dark socks, and a pair of oxblood color saddle Oxfords. Everywhere I went, I received compliments on my attire. Everywhere except IBM, that is. At work, I was usually greeted with stares and whispers behind my back. Being the naive 20-year-old that I was, I actually thought they were admiring my beautiful and expensive clothes. That thought ended when my supervisor called me into his office and told me that IBM had a strict dress code and that my radical attire would not be condoned here. But nobody had discussed the dress code with me. Every man there wore a dark suit and white shirt, so I guess it was assumed that I would, too. Well, I was in shock. Here I was, the epitome of high fashion, and that was not acceptable at IBM. They wanted all of their service reps to look the same, like penguins, and if I wanted to work there, I would have to conform. Well, I had just about had my fill of fighting with Dallas traffic and the one-hour commute each way to and from home, so I bid IBM adieu and made a very fashionable exit. It's hard to be a pheasant when you're surrounded by penguins anyway. Did you know that between 1942 and 1945, Whitman's, the well-known chocolate company that started in 1842 as a confectionery shop in Philadelphia, sent 6 million pounds of chocolate to overseas servicemen in land, sea, and air tins. Women on Whitman's production lines slipped notes into the boxes to comfort the fighting men. Many of those letters resulted in long-term friendships and even some post-war marriages. Here's a flashback fun fact for you. On April 19th of 1956, actress Grace Kelly married Prince Rainier of Monaco. The event was broadcast live on TV with an estimated audience of 30 million people worldwide. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Lisa Maxwell, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.